Good afternoon, listeners. You are tuned to The Bridge airing on KMGP, broadcasting from Magnuson Park. The Bridge is an hour-long public affairs program that connects you to your neighborhood, to your community, and to life in the Pacific Northwest. We call our show The Bridge because Seattle is a city of bridges. We have 130 of them, and they connect us to one another. Co-hosts for The Bridge are Julietta Ross and me, Jean Gunn. Julietta founded this station, Space 101.1 FM. SPACE stands for Sandpoint Arts and Culture Exchange. Julietta is an arts and historic preservation activist. She worked for just about every organization with Seattle in its name. Seattle Symphony, Seattle Art Museum, and Seattle Weekly, just to name a few. And then there is me, Jean Cotton. I wrote columns for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and then for the Seattle Times before I quit what some call the best job in town to run for office in 2003. To everyone's surprise, and especially me, I won, and I went on to serve 3 terms, 12 years. Today, I write for postalley.org, and I do research and interviews for this program. Today, we are especially honored to have 2 guests, Seattle Then and Now writer Clay Eales and Elisa Law, Executive Director of Friends of Magnuson Park. Clay, along with writing for the Seattle Times now and then, you also are a historian, author, photographer, and journalist. Tell us a little more about your background.
Oh my, well, you might say I have ink in my veins. My constant joke is that when I die and they cut me open, there's no blood coming out, just black ink. I've been doing journalism since I was actually a little kid. Did my own neighborhood newspaper during 1962, the year of the World's Fair. And I've written for all kinds of papers in the Northwest, and then, you know, you're always on the sideline as a journalist, and so you're always tempted to get involved. And I kind of jumped into the fire back in the late 80s into historic preservation when the Admiral Theater in West Seattle was threatened, and I became president of the Historical Society then. So I kind of have a dual identity as a journalist and as well as a preservation advocate.
Well, dual identities are good. I think most of us have them these days.
You know all about that, Jean.
Elisa, as executive director of Friends of Magnuson Park Historic District, you've been active in celebrating the history of the park, once Sandpoint Naval Air Station. Tell us how you became involved in working with the Friends, and tell us about some of the Friends' activities.
Yeah, you know, I got first involved in 2020 when they hired me to design an exhibit. That's my background. I graduated from the UW's museology program to do an exhibit for them on the First World Flight. They were just planning ahead for the centennial, which is this year. And then, of course, I got the bug learning about the flight and designing the exhibit. And then they said, all right, well, that was great. What else can you do? Do you want to steer this ship? And I said, yeah, let's give it a go. So I've been at the helm since the end of 2020. And some of the things that Friends does, Friends of Madison Park was established in 2002 as a response to concerns about how the Navy transition from the transfer of the Sandpoint back to King County from the Navy, how that was going to affect all the historic buildings in the district. A bunch of neighbors got together, and activists and historians, and formed Friends of Magnuson Park to protect the history of Sandpoint. And so they're really responsible for the national site designation of of Sandpoint and also the local historic district designation in 2011.
Well, one of the things that brought us together today is the park's significant role in aviation history. And as listeners may know, this year marks the centennial of the first around-the-world flight that took off from Sandpoint April 6, 1924. What would we have seen if we had been among the 300 spectators who watched those four biplanes begin their attempt to circumnavigate the world? What would we see?
A fair amount of trepidation and doubt, I'd say. Excitement, too. But I remember they're one of my favorite quotes that I've read about the first world flight and kind of that captures the feeling going into it was a friend talking to one of the flyers saying, "Why don't you just crook your toe in the trigger and get it over with?" That's the kind of faith that a lot of folks had that this was even possible then. And so I think a lot of people thought that they were, you know, waving goodbye for the last time to these eight men in their four Douglas World Cruisers as they took off from Lake Washington.
What would you have seen if you were there, Clay?
Well, like Elisa said, this was because it was unprecedented. This is a lot of excitement combined with anxiety. And what I've learned from looking at the old newspapers about this is that this day was a long time in coming, and it kind of it sputtered along. In other words, it didn't all go perfectly as planned. Of course, the flight itself didn't all go as planned, as Elisa will tell you. But just the prep to get to this point of the takeoff was a big deal.
Oh, how was that? What was it that held them up at the beginning?
Well, first of all, there was before the Douglas World Cruiser was designed by Donald Douglas, there was no airplane that could even attempt these huge jumps. The first jump across the Pacific. The first test flight of these planes was from Santa Monica to Seattle before they left it off. And in that test flight, there were several mishaps that set them back in their schedule.
Even
before they got started, like I said, it wasn't looking good at the offset.
I hope I'm not stepping on Gene's toes, but how did this idea even come down to these pilots, like fly around the world when you can barely go from Santa Monica to Seattle?
Great question. I mean, this was a really exciting time in aviation. All around the world, people are pushing the boundaries of what's possible. This is the first, you know, every day in the newspaper you're hearing about the first mid-air refueling or the first flight from here to there. Like they're pushing duration and altitude and what's possible. And in 1923, there's whispers about an attempt to go around the world coming from coming from England, France, Italy, Portugal, Argentina, all these other countries have got a dog in the race, so to speak. And America is kind of the underdog. And General Mason Patrick, who was leading the Army Air Service, is like, well, America can't miss out on this opportunity to show what we can do. And they kind of scrambled together this plan and this plane and these flyers pretty quickly.
Huh. Did they get off easily when they got started?
No.
No.
They didn't. I think they had meant to start off on April 4th, and then right on takeoff, the flagship plane Seattle, piloted by their commander, messed up his pontoon, and then they had to stay back and repair. So there were a lot more people here at Sandpoint to see them off on the 4th, and then not as many came back on the 6th, which is when they actually took off. So, I mean, yeah, it was, they were having problems from the beginning.
What were some of those difficulties?
Well, right now, for instance, 100 years ago, that same Seattle airplane named after Seattle, is now missing in Alaska somewhere. And the other three airplanes and their crews are waiting to hear word of their discovery or their, you know, for better or for worse. And they're missing for 10 days. It's just the weather. You have to understand, the airplane is an open air cockpit in an airplane made out of wood and cloth and wire. They have no radio, no air, no parachute, no life jackets. They barely have like an extra pair of underwear. It's like, and they're flying by dead reckoning, and it's just incredibly dangerous, and they're flying where no man has ever gone before. So, you know, the challenges are mostly mechanical and weather related, and they're just having a lot of that very early on.
What did the planes look like? They were biplanes, and there were just two seats, one for the pilot and one for the mechanic. What were they like?
Clay, you want me to take that one?
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
You're right. Biplane, open cockpit, two-seater biplanes, humongous planes, really. One of the ugliest planes ever built. But was it made to be pretty? It was made to carry as much gasoline as would be necessary to make these long trips.
It must have been freezing.
Yeah, they had icicles in their nostril hairs.
Oh, my God.
As they landed.
How close were the other competitors to taking off at the same time? I mean, this was almost like a race?
It was a race. It wasn't official. It's not like they all took off from the same place at the same time. But the newspapers were certainly saying, you know, here's where the British flyers are. Here's where the Portuguese. Everyone was following all of the flyers and their progress. And you know, they all took off in 1924, I'm pretty sure. And most of them took off from Europe going an easterly route, where the American team took off going a westerly route from the States. And in terms of who got the furthest, I mean, we not to not to big spoiler alert, but we won the race. America won, and I'm not sure how far the other teams really got, if anybody got more than halfway around. I don't think so.
Well, what were some of the first adverse conditions that they faced? You say that it didn't go well when they went to take off.
Right. I think they maybe had too much weight in the airplane was one of the issues when the Seattle took off, and that's kind of what dragged the pontoon and got it damaged. But some of the weather up in Alaska is notoriously windy. There's these winds called Willy Waws, which I won't attempt to describe what they are or how they happen. I'm not a meteorologist. I don't know. But, you know, these are there's these air pockets they describe that just drop them 100 feet out of the air all of a sudden. You can imagine. You can only imagine.
No, thank you.
And, you know, there's real thick fog, so you can't see 10 feet in front of your face. And then an iceberg right in front of you. You're trying to move this behemoth of a plane out of the way.
Let's talk about that first mishap that they suffered. The real one.
The real one. The big crash in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
So April 30th. When was that? Tuesday? Mm. On Tuesday this week, 100 years ago, they set off from Canatok. I don't know if I'm saying that. Canatok, Alaska. The Seattle did to catch up with the other team. They had been laid up there for 2 weeks making repairs from another incident that they had. And they hit some bad weather and crashed into a mountain. And were missing for 10 days. Everyone thought they were goners. They burnt pieces of the plane to stay warm the first night. They realized in the fog that no one was going to be able to find them, though many people were looking. They had sent out Navy destroyers and Coast Guard cutters and all manner of fishing boats and ships to go and try and find them. But the fog was so bad, no one was going to be able to see where they were, let alone allowing them to navigate from where they were, because they don't have radios or GPS or anything like that. They're just looking at a map and trying to figure out where they are. And so the first 6 or 7 days, they are just wandering through the wilderness, shooting at rabbits, surviving on condensed milk, not condensed milk, on liquid rations, and sleeping in alder thickets until miraculously they come upon a trapper's cabin that's full of pancakes, which is their salvation. And they find a can from Port Moeller, which is nearby, maybe 15 or 20 miles from where they were in that trapper's cabin. And that was the breadcrumb they needed to get to safety. And you can imagine the hullabaloo when they walked out of the wilderness towards the cannery, and everyone everyone's looking for them, and they've kind of long thought that there's no way these guys are alive, and they come walking out of the wilderness, and the stick that the commander has is now in the collection at Mohai. Fun fact.
Talk about how the blighters were received on the 74. Stops along the way, were they greeted happily, or were there hostile conditions? What was it like when they were stopped doing?
Well, as they got closer and closer to their finishing the flight, the receptions became crazier and crazier. And that's not to say, even in the very beginning, their first landing in Japan was... they're met by dignitaries and they're feted and celebrated and treated like heroes, because they are. This was, I don't know if we'll get to this, so I wanted to make sure I mentioned it. What's important about this flight is that though it was a competition among nations, it was an internationally cooperative peacetime military operation. It was a human shared experience to accomplish this feat, and the flyers were all helping each other. It wasn't like, great, these guys are out of the race, good, that means we can win. Everyone was trying to keep each other in the race to make sure that someone could do it, and they were all celebrating each other, which is really, it's really beautiful.
It is.
Well, it was kind of almost a goodwill kind of thing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So that when they, for instance, landed in Japan, how were they received?
Oh, they were the Japanese children were parading around with American flags and singing American patriotic songs. They did like a sumo wrestling display, and they were served by geisha, and there's a big cultural kind of festival celebration for their landing. And they stopped in several places in Japan along the way, and everywhere they went, there was something special planned for them.
And what about backup? I mean, they had repairs that had to be made, some of those things along the way. How did they get that?
Constantly needing repairs. We use that phrase now in like a corporate setting, that you're building the plane while you're flying it. Well, they were actually building the plane sometimes while they were flying it. But there was a huge multi-department cooperation happening to make this a possibility. Like the Navy sent out 36 destroyers strategically around the world to look for them if they are crashed in the ocean, to hold their extra supplies. I think they went through, they went through 2 dozen engines, all on the way around the world. The crates that all of the supplies were packed in were made out of spruce so that they could rip the crate apart to make repairs to the airplane. You know, really everything that they could have needed was on those carriers positioned around the world. They couldn't have done it without the support of the Coast Guard, the Navy, the fisheries.
Well, think about the mechanics of the thing alone. How did they get those supplies that they needed to replace engines and other parts?
You know, sometimes it was pretty hairy. It was a pretty hairy situation. So, what was French Indochina, and now I guess. Not, I don't want to reveal my geographic ignorance. I don't know exactly where that would have been now, maybe outside of Vietnam. Someone crash landed in a lagoon and needed a new engine. So the other plane kept on going to the nearest town where they would be able to get an engine shipped from one of the planes. And then they had to try to find their way back to that part of the jungle by land where that plane was moored and waiting, and that the whole story of them getting the engine and getting it onto a buggy and through the jungle to save the guys is its own adventure story. You know,
maybe you can write a book after this, and it'll be like Boys in the Boat or something.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It absolutely should have.
Hollywood is calling.
Yeah, it's got Boys in the Boat gravitas and entertainment for sure.
Well, what about the diplomatic situation? Did the U.S. government somehow or another, I don't know whether they had to have visas. How did that work? They were 74 different stops.
There were 74 to 76 stops, 22 countries. And, you know, I've never seen like any visa information about how they arranged that, but I do know that there were six divisions. The world was separated into six divisions, and each division had an advance officer that was kind of paving the way for them ahead. And you know, the logistics team. No one talks about logistics because it's not as interesting, obviously, than the actual flight. But the logistics alone of where these folks were where they were going to land, and how they were going to cross, you know, say Russian airspace, or, you know, even landing in Japan was a big deal then. The relations between U.S. and Japan were not that great. But they patched it up in order to see this achievement happen.
What about the in-between times? I mean, did they all arrive at their destination at the same time, or did they have to have sometimes wait between catching up, or maybe those that there are only three now, of course. Do they have to wait sometimes for somebody who was a little slow or having some difficulties?
For the most part, they stuck together after that. There wasn't a time that I can remember where a plane was left behind for any length of time. Not like the Seattle. The Seattle just was kind of doomed from the get-go.
Well, after the Seattle crash, that is. The other three, what was it? The Boston, New Orleans, and
Chicago.
They would get there all pretty much at the same time.
Pretty much. Sometimes, you know, there'd be maybe an hour lag if someone was having engine trouble. They had to fly lower and slower, or land and make a repair and then catch up. But I'd say for the most part, they were traveling together after that, after Alaska.
Do you know what these pilots did when they were done with this amazing flight? Like, what happened to their lives?
I mean, they all had incredible careers. I haven't done my diligence of kind of memorizing what, but I know that Eric Nelson, who worked for the Boeing company after the flight and lived in Seattle and was a member of the Swedish Club, and Frederick Martin, who crashed the plane in Alaska, was from Bellingham and came back, and they all continue to fly, and most of them did not have any children. And I'd like to surmise that their love of flight kind of kept them from having children, because mm-hmm. they knew that, you know, they could just die any time they went up there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listeners, we have it is time to pause for a minute during our conversation with Clay Eales and Alisa Law to remind you that you are tuned to Space 101.1 FM. We invite you to become part of our community station, volunteering, or donating. We encourage you to check out the station at 101.org to learn more about the station activities and to listen to earlier programs. But back to today's discussion with historian Clay Eales and Friends of Magnuson's Alisa Law. We have been talking about the first around-the-world flight that took off from Sandpoint 100 years ago. Are there ways we can follow that amazing 175-day journey?
Thanks for that wonderful segue. Yes, there are. One of the programs that we're putting together is on Instagram and Facebook. If you follow at First World Flight Centennial, we are posting every day between when they left from Seattle on April 6th and when they landed back here on September 28th. And so if you want to check in and see, I wonder what's happening with the flyers now. Oh, one of them's missing, crashed in Alaska. Cool. And then every day you can kind of track them as they cross the Pacific and head to India and then up into Europe and across through Iceland, and they have all kinds of adventures.
Did you see some old newspapers where they're like, really? I just hear the kid going, extra, extra.
Absolutely. Yeah, they make the front page, mm-hmm. You know, Major Martin missing again. Or, you know, flyers, next stop, Unalaska. Mm-hmm. People were really paying attention. You know, New York Times, Washington Post, Seattle, obviously, mm-hmm. all over Alaska. There's newspapers galore mm-hmm. talking about.
That's cool.
Do we have quite as much coverage now at this moment?
You mean of the centennial itself?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we've had a little bit. I did a column on this that ran last month for the beginning, and there have been a couple of other media stories, but I suspect the big hoo-ha is going to come near the end, and that's quite appropriate because the real thing to celebrate is that they did make it through all of those problems. They did make it, and that's the real thing to celebrate, and that'll come the weekend of September 28th.
Tell us about what we are going to do when on September 28th. Are we making plans for the conclusion of the flight?
Huge plans. So we're in talks with, this is a partnership between Friends of Magnuson Park and the Museum of Flight. And so we have a 4-day event planned where vintage aircraft and aircraft that have flown around the world in different categories, I won't get into details. I don't want to misspeak. But are going to be on display at Museum of Flight. So you can go and see them and learn about them. And then on September 28th, when the Flyers returned to Seattle 100 years ago, we will be on the shores of Lake Washington on the campus of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA building, the NOAA campus, celebrating with speakers and food trucks and displays and vendors and the aircraft flyover, and it'll be a really fun big celebration.
And I have to say, this is all to the credit of Friends of Magnuson Park. Incredible organization. I mean, there's the cliche out there, any excuse for a party, right? Well, a centennial is certainly a great excuse or reason, but the Friends have really taken hold of this and done a deep dive into the history of this, and I think that without their work, we still would not really know about these guys and this feat.
I believe you.
You know, there are many famous names in aviation, and most of them whom we know are famous because of their singular feats. You know, we like to make a hero out of one person. But this is a group, and I think that may be part of the reason that it's still not quite part of cultural literacy yet. But what the Friends are doing is fighting that uphill battle, and I think it's going to pay off down the road. Definitely the Boys in the Sky, you know? I hope Hollywood comes calling.
Yeah.
Will there be exhibits here and elsewhere?
Right now, there's an exhibit on view at Mercy Magnuson, which is the old Navy Barracks, Building 9. It's in the very center, and it's open to the public Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, for free. And it features, Full Circle to where we started. That was the exhibit that I put together for them in 2020. So it's still on display, and it's also available for free on the First World Flight Centennial website for libraries and schools and anybody who would want to print out the panels and have them on display in their place. We'd love to raise awareness.
Well, there is some place we can go to see some kind of a replica of this in any way at all, or is that something that might be in the works?
A replica of, say, a Douglas World Cruiser?
Well, no, maybe exhibits or possibly some of the artifacts. That maybe there are some of the old suits that we could look at when you had to go off into the cold with only just your fur-lined suit.
Right. You know, someone has those suits. It might be the Smithsonian, but the artifacts that we have here in Seattle we have Major Martin's walking stick from when he, you know, emerged from the Alaska crash. We have a Union Jack flag that was given to them when they landed in Prince Rupert, their first stop. We have a propeller, the shell of a bullet that was shot went to signal the end of the First World Flight here at Sandpoint. So those things are at Museum of History and Industries archives and at the Museum of Flight, and there are photographs obviously in the UW Special Collections. But in terms of an exhibit that's dedicated to and have brought all those artifacts together, none that I've heard of. Clay, have you heard of any? Adam?
No, but you know, don't hide your light under a bushel basket. That website you have, firstworldflightcentennial.org, has got incredible visuals on it that people can go to any time of the day or night. They've really done this up well.
Thank you.
Have other locations, are they doing the same thing? And are you in cahoots with them?
Good question. You know, I would not be surprised if Seattle had to really fight tooth and nail to become the official start and end of the flight 100 years ago. And I think Santa Monica, where they picked up the planes and did their first test flight, would probably still say today that, well, it really started here because they picked up their planes there. Mm-hmm. And we could do a whole radio show around, you know, why that's not true.
Take that, Santa Monica.
Yeah. Any Santa Monicans listening, I'm sorry. I love Santa Monica. But Eugene, Oregon, also, they landed there on their way up to Seattle. And so Eugene has a monument that says that the first four flyers were there. Mm. But in terms of being in cahoots, I will say that as a part of that 175-day Follow the Journey effort that we're making, each time the flyers are about to approach a new stop of their 76 stops, we reach out to the libraries, the local town halls, the tourism bureaus, and we say, hey, did you know that this happened 100 years ago? And 10 out of 10, at this point, every city has been like, well, I didn't know. Wow, that's so cool. Tell us more. And so we're doing a pretty good job of creating some hype, not only locally, but nationally. And the whole purpose of it is just to raise this event back to the top of our consciousness. Like Clay was saying, I think it's been all but forgotten.
Well, it was a unifying event instead of a divisive event. So that's really something that people should latch on to. And I think that's great that you're doing that.
Absolutely.
Tell us about the how we got that memorial right there at 74th and Sandpoint Way in front of the entrance to Magnuson Park. And, of course, that is a marker to mark the flight around the world, is it not?
Yeah, that's right. And it was installed there in 1924 in advance of their landing, and the flyers were taken out to see it, and they had the unveiling the day after they arrived. So on the 29th of September, they unveiled it. It was carved by Victor Alonzo Lewis, who also did the gargoyles at UW and Winged Victory at the Capitol. He's a quite well-known local sculptor. And there are other monuments, not quite as grand, around the world also that we'll be kind of exploring in our 175-day
So journey. That's the sort of the commemorative. Who did that particular, and how does it sort of, it has wings on the top, and it's quite a large pinnacle, a monument.
Yeah, you know, I always describe it as a winged obelisk. And if you can brave the crossing on 74th and Sandpoint Way to go up and look at it, it has a plaque on it that names all the flyers and has an etching of the Douglas World Cruisers. But, you know, it is something that we were looking at having moved, because it's moved four times from its original location.
Oh, it moved.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Originally, it was on the old Sandpoint Airfield, where NOAA is now. Mm. And then a plane, you know, 10 years after or so it was installed, clipped its wing on it. And they were like, well, you should probably move this from the airfield. And so it moved kind of where Hangar 30 is now, and they had to move it when Hangar 30 was built. And then they moved it again after the Navy was popping up buildings all over the place to where it is today. So that's its fourth location. But still, very difficult to figure out who owns it and who can make the decision to move it if we wanted to move it somewhere else and in the park and have it be given a little bit more room to breathe.
Yeah. And you have to go through landmarks for that, right?
You do have to have a landmarks approval for that, because it's a contributing resource of the historic district, right?
Well, getting into just a slightly different subject, Clay, talk a little bit about your work with Now and Then.
Well, as you alluded to at the beginning, Now and Then is a column that started in 1982, and most of us know and revere the name of Paul Dorpat. He started it back then. It got started Paul, in his heart of hearts, is an artist, and he really didn't see himself as a historian at the time, but he did a couple of articles, one of them for the old Seattle Star. And he also put together these quirky booklets for the mayor's small business task force, one of them called 294 Glimpses of Seattle, and it sold for $2.94. He marketed it as a penny per glimpse. Mm. And Eric Lasitas, whom we know from the Seattle Times, he's still doing it. He wrote a couple of columns about this booklet, and it flew off the shelves, sold out tens of thousands of them. And this is really what became his entree to start the Now and Then column in the magazine of the Sunday Times. Mm. 1982, that's a long time ago. Imagine this. What has any of us done for 37 years in a row, every single week?
Single week.
1,800 columns in a row. Paul did that. It's an incredible feat. I can't imagine that it has been done by anyone else anywhere in the country. And we all love it because, well, face it, the brilliance of the column is that the text is short. You can read it in a few minutes and be enthralled by the photos. And the kiss of death for any kind of story that is super long is you say, oh, that looks good. I'll read it later. Mm-hmm. And you never do. Well, this was going week after week after week. Now, Paul kind of faded out about 5 years ago. He retired, and Gene Sherard and I, both of whom have been friends of Paul, we've been friends of Paul for, gosh, 30, 35 years in various capacities. We kind of became the heirs apparent, and the Times has been great to us in carrying on the column and carrying on the tradition of Paul. There may be a few in the audience out there who don't know the column. The concept is pretty simple. You take an long ago old photo that's compelling in itself, and then you take a photo from the exact same vantage point today. That's where you get the now and then aspect. And Paul always likened it to a game of hide and seek. He said people love to compare, to say, well, that's there in today. Well, ooh, that has changed. How has this changed? And so it makes for a fascinating visual puzzle. And we've tried to carry it on in much the same way, but we've added a few elements to it. One of them that is, I think, pretty important is that we've tried to pick then photos that have people in them, and we've also tried to populate our now photos with people. So getting back to the first world flight, when we did the now photo, we made sure to have a strong contingent from the Friends of Magnuson Park in the now photo, and to try to approximate the location of where the flight took off. And it's been a lot of fun. I'm not sure I'm going to be doing it for 37 years like Paul. I mean, I'd have to live to 105 or so.
Well, I don't know why not.
But it's a fun pursuit, and I can't tell you the number of people, and there are still people out there who take the print Times, but Gene and I get this all the time. You know, you're the first thing we turn to when the paper comes, and that's very heartening, very heartening.
Well, does it take an awful lot of delving to find out those long ago views? I mean, how do you come up with a new feature every week?
Well, people call or email us with ideas, but we're looking for ideas all the time. One thing that we've tried to
take... So how would we submit an idea if we had one?
Well, the easiest way to remember is our website, our blog, which is pauldorpat.com. Paul, P-A-U-L, Dorpat, D-O-R-P-A-T.com. Our contact info is on there. And so one of the things we try to do is to be timely with our topics. And again, First World Flight is a good example. You know, we wanted to time that column for the weekend that the flight took off. And that gives it a little extra oomph for a reader. But we come up with ideas on all our own. I'll tell you one that's coming up in a couple of weeks that just came out of the blue by looking at the old tax photos from the mid-30s. Did you know that there was a tavern near what is now the Seattle Center whose name was Don't Argue?
Oh, no.
You know,
I love
so
it.
So some of these, you know, some of them are important historical events or significant in a number of ways, and some of them are just fun.
Well, it sounds fun. Tell us about Paul. Paul isn't active with you anymore. Where is he, and tell us how he's doing?
He's not far from where we're sitting right here at Sand Point. He's up on the borderline between Seattle and Shoreline in a care center called Avamere, which used to be Park Ridge Care Center. He's been there for a couple of years. He's still very congenial. He loves to banter, loves to argue. Mm-hmm. I mean,
well, we know he loves to argue.
And I just visited him yesterday. We go see him as often as we can, and there are a number of friends of his up there. And wonderfully enough, you don't have to prepare or make an appointment. You can just go visit him if you know him. He loves to talk to new people, people he hasn't met before. But
he might be making some new friends as the show goes on.
Absolutely, absolutely. And and he kind of holds court. He doesn't have the historical knowledge in his head that he used to. You know, where does all that stuff go when we get older? I keep pondering that all the time. But the best thing we all can do to support him is to go and have a great conversation in real time. You know, that's probably a good lesson for anybody who's you know, confined to a place. But yeah. Paul in particular, and he still has his joy de vivre.
Oh, nice. That's good to hear.
Is it true that he gave his immense photo archive to the Seattle Public Library?
Absolutely. And it is so immense and complex that they had to find extra money in the Seattle Library Foundation, and that took a while, to hire somebody as a professional archivist for a 2-year period that started last summer. And that position will end after 2 years, but they are predicting that they won't be done getting through it all, cataloging it, inputting the metadata. That's all of the details about not only what the photos and films and negatives and so forth are depicting, but also where they came from. And, you know, it's a massive collection. There are a few of us who had the privilege of going down into Paul's basement when he lived in Wallingford.
Yes, I understood his basement was full.
Yeah.
And unindexed or anything?
Well, parts of it were categorized, but parts of it, sadly, we weren't able to drain all of Paul's brain before it went to the library. And so that's part of the challenge. But it's also part of the heartening aspect of the Seattle Library Foundation. You see, Paul had a vision for his materials, which I don't think most of us do. You know, we've all got attics and boxes stuffed away places, and it's a topic that a lot of times we avoid about, you know, who's going to get our stuff when we're gone, and who is it important to? Well, Paul all along had a vision. He wanted it to go to the Seattle Public Library because that is the one institution in town. There are many that collect and make available historic materials, but that is the one institution where you can access them according to their mission for free. He called it the voice of the people, Vox Populi. And he not only wanted his materials to go to the library, he also wanted the fact of his donation there to inspire other people to give their materials to the library. And so the people, the great people of the Seattle Room up at the top of the downtown library, they are taking good care of the materials and going over them carefully. And someday, we hope soon, they will be made available for searching, for accessing. It's a tremendous legacy.
Eliza, besides the Friends of Magnuson Park, you have worked on a number of historic projects. The Women's Suffrage Centennial, the display titled The Way We See Native America, and the Vashon Heritage Project. Are there other exhibits you are undertaking?
Right now, the Vashon Heritage Museum is about to reopen in July. Their whole museum's been gutted and renovated with a National Endowment for Humanities grant. So I'm really working a lot on that right now. And I also work for HistoryLink as a project manager. And we're they're not exhibits, but we have a couple of projects, one on the on Jim Ellis and his legacy. His autobiography came to our hands, and we published it, and it's that'll have a launch in June, co-hosted by the Seattle Public Library. Speaking of the Seattle Public Library and its archives, and we also got his whole collection and his personal papers, which will be transferred to the library for the same reason Clay mentioned, that it's free and open to the public. And we wanted Jim's Jim's lessons of leadership to be available to our future civic leaders. And there's all kinds of projects I could talk about. Oh, and one that you might be interested in particular is next year, we'll be publishing a book on the history of the Seattle Central waterfront, kind of timed with the opening of Waterfront Park.
Well, this looks like a fascinating career. We'll be able to have any display that features the historic Around the World flight anywhere?
Right now, it's here at Magnuson Park at Mercy Magnuson. You can come see it Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. It's also available online at firstworldflightcentennial.org for download if you want to put it up in your local library or museum or home. If you have 60 feet of space, you can totally put that in your hallway. That's kind of the big thing that's planned.
Maybe it'll have to go on the road as this centennial takes flight. Other people will be interested in the other locations. Who knows?
Right. That's the hope.
Are there other anniversaries that we should be celebrating out here at Magnuson Park?
Ooh, that's a good one. I might need to think about that for a little bit.
Well, that's sort of an off-the-wall question,
probably. Magnuson Park Gallery is
going
to turn 10 soon.
It seemed like it would be something we would ask. I mean, Magnuson Park has a lot of that sort of thing around, like the submarine fins that are sort of historic in their way. And we have quite a lot of things that are historic. As a matter of fact, if we go through the gate to NOAA, we can see Soundgarden, which sort of where the musical group took its name from Soundgarden. So there are quite a lot of historic things. Other things that we should think about when we're out here?
You know, when you're out here, I would plug our self-guided tour, which you can find on the Friends of Magnuson Park website. That'll take you around to all of the buildings in the Sandpoint Historic District, of which there are over 30, and tell you a little bit about what their original uses were, when they were built, what kind of architecture they are featuring. There's a lot of great Art Deco and Colonial Revival style architecture out here. So, you know, my vision and hope for Friends and for the historic district is that we continue to create engaging kind of programming for folks to do it at their own pace and their own speed. And so keep an eye out for new and exciting things to come.
Clay, getting back to you, you published a story about a young musician, Scott Goodman, facing the music. And also, Every Time a Bell Rings, a biography of Catherine Grimes, who played Zuzu in It's a Wonderful Life. Do you have a new book in the works?
Tell us
about your new book, if any.
Well, both of those are biographies, and I really believe as on the street type historian that biographies are among the best, if not the best, way to learn history, because you identify with the subject. And Steve Goodman was a terrific musician, my favorite all-time performer. Carolyn Grimes played Zuzu in the movie It's a Wonderful Life, and she remains a lifelong friend. Then there's one book project that's sort of hanging on my shoulder that I'm not sure I'm going to get to. I've had it on my shoulder for almost 25 years now.
Oh, 25 years.
Yes. Yeah, and it's a biography of Fred Hutchinson. He's sort of Seattle's Mickey Mantle, homegrown hero of baseball. And really, when you say the name Fred Hutchinson, most people these days don't think of baseball. They think of the Cancer Research Center that was named after him by his surgeon brother after Fred died of lung cancer in 1964. But Fred was an ace pitcher. He was minor league player of the year playing for the Seattle Rainiers. He came from Franklin High School. He went on to pitch for the Detroit Tigers and and managed three teams. He took the Cincinnati Reds to the World Series. And I've interviewed more than 100 people for the book, and you know, everything from family members to famous names that even if you're not a baseball fan, you know, Yogi Berra, Warren Spahn, Stan Musial, guys like that who are no longer living. But I just haven't been able to pull the trigger. There's just, Elisa said, there's too much to do out there. And I'm trying to find a theme for it. And one that I've been kicking around lately is one of the four criteria for the original Hutch Award in honor of Fred. Can you imagine today a criterion for an award being called manliness?
Ooh.
This is, and I'm thinking that kind of sends the hairs up the back of my neck, that might be a good title for a book, you know? I'm still working on it. I've got friends helping me out. I just, you know, it's like anything else. You got to make time for it. And but I do have an archive of Fred Hutchinson's stuff. And, you know, even if the book doesn't get done, that archive will be valuable someday to somebody down the line.
Definitely.
Well, you're both fantastically marvelous to talk to about your history project. Anything else we should know about that we, you know, is coming up for you, Elisa?
I think I went through the list, but definitely come see us at NOAA on September 28th for the big shebang in the fall. Mark your calendar.
Yeah. Can you give us the website and the Facebook and all that one
yep.
more time?
It's www.firstworldflightcentennial.org and on Facebook and Instagram at First World Flight Centennial.
Great.
And how about you, Clay? Is there other, I mean, I mentioned the book, but there must be other projects you have in the works.
Oh, I'm a West Seattle guy from way back, and we're trying to save this stone cottage and site it somewhere along the beach in West Seattle. We were able to save it and move it. Now we're in the process of finding a site for it. So there are always causes like that going on, and I'm on the committee for that. And you know, the column, the Now and Then column, people should know it's not just in the print paper. It's online on seattletimes.com. And then we have a blog, I mentioned it before, pauldorpat.com, where we replicate the column. But, you know, online you have unlimited space. So we put dozens, sometimes hundreds of web extras, we call them, videos, photos, extra items. And so it's a fun thing to subscribe to. Go to pauldorpat.com, enter your email address in the upper left, and each week you'll get an update with these fun historical topics with lots of extras to delve into.
Do both of you get contacted by university students or other students a lot? Not so much?
No, yeah. but we get contacted by... when I say we, Gene Sherrard and I, for Now and Then, we get contacted by all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. We did have a college student who grew up next to a landslide in West Seattle that happened 100 years ago, and he wanted to honor the people whose lives were lost in that, and that became the germ of a column I did last fall. So, yeah. You know, ideas come from everywhere.
That's great.
Well, finally, we have come to the end of the hour. Co-host Julietta Ross and I have been talking to historian Clay Eales and Friends of Magnuson's Elisa Law. Thanks to you both for taking the time to come in and talk to us about some exciting projects.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This has been fun. Thanks.
It always is. And the hour always just seems to go so fast, I can hardly believe it. Listeners, you've been tuned to Space 101.1 FM. We invite you to check out the station at 101.org. And while there, listen about station activities and hear about listen to some of the latest broadcasts. We will be back next Thursday, May 9th, to talk to Lisa Steinbrook about the controversy over the totem poles at Pike Place Market. Until then, it's farewell from Juliana and from me, Jean Gott.